Can't get enough of America's undocumented anchorman? SteinOnline.com is your one-stop shop for all things Stein. Catch new episodes of The Mark Stein Show. Sit back and experience features like Stein's Song of the Week and Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time. Get the most of Stein Online by joining the Mark Stein Club, a global community of people just like you. The show never stops for members of the Mark Stein Club. Head on over to steinonline.com/club for details.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. May the 7th, 2025. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, 9 p.m. in the Sistine Chapel, where the papal conclave is underway, 10 p.m. in Riyadh, where a Houthi missile intended for Jerusalem fell a little short and landed in Saudi Arabia. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight in Muzaffarabad in the Pakistani part of Kashmir, which came under attack by the Indian Air Force Tuesday night. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, sorry about that. 6 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, where the Australian right, so-called, is already drawing all the wrong conclusions from the weekend's election disaster. 8 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more civilized hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Speaking of which, Greg Warren writes, he's dissatisfied. I should give you a heads up. He's dissatisfied with our traditional recitation of the time zones. Greetings, Mark, says Greg. I was wondering if you would be good enough to add Central Western Time, GMT, plus 8 hours and 45 minutes to your countdown of time zones across His Majesty's increasingly dodgy dominions. Surely the three-quarter hour difference is enough to put Nepal in its place. Failing that, I can I'll only offer you the temptation of including metropoli such as Cocklebiddy, which must number Stein Club members amongst its teeming hordes of prospectors. My eyesight's gone to pieces. Can't read that word. And bush rangers. For myself, I will be blissfully with Morpheus in one of those time zones for which you profess sorrow. I've worked out where this is now. Central West. This is Australian Central Western Time, where it's. Let me work out what this is now. So it's 3 p.m. It's 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. So another 8 hours means it's 4:45 in the morning in the Central Western Time Zone, 4:45 a.m. And that's just, I know I've been in this time zone. It's sort of on the border between South Australia and West Australia. I think it's the southern bit. I don't think it goes all the way up. Anyway, thank you for that, Greg. But no, we're not. I don't think we're, it's not an official time zone, I don't think. It just seems to be observed as such. Chris Davis says, why are we talking? You're probably wondering why we're talking about obscure, unofficial Australian time zones when we're on the brink of nuclear Armageddon, and that's a fair point. Chris Davis writes, Mark, I hope you're well. Now that India versus Pakistan has escalated towards a hot war, how many Indians and Pakistanis can we British folks expect will return to their mother country to take up arms? They don't need to return to the mother country, which I take it you mean is India, although back in the day, Britain was India's mother country. Anyway, they don't need to go back to India to take up arms. They'll be taking up arms on the streets of Leicester, like they did for some cricket match. Do you remember that? It was like a cricket match in between India and Pakistan, and India won. And the next thing you know, the town's aflame. Just a couple of years ago. Or is the reality, says Chris Davis, that we will be providing asylum to millions? You really don't want to get into the business of providing asylum to Indians and Pakistanis, because there's over a billion of them. I think we both know the answer, but would welcome your vista. This is, if you haven't heard, India and Pakistan go to war fairly regularly. It's always a bit of a gamble because I think it's, what is it, five times since 1947? And in recent decades, of course, the worry is that they've their nuclear powers of a kind. But their nuclear powers, who've got the they're not like Russia. They're not sitting on a huge stockpile, and the general theory is that the fewer you have, the more incentive there is to use them sooner. And that's one of the problems here with India and Pakistan. Pakistan is definitely going to retaliate. The whole thing, the Pakistani military, their whole theory is retaliation plus. You can't just match what India has done. You've got to take it to the next step. Well, if people keep taking it to the next step, eventually that's going to cause a bit of a problem on the broader scene. But anyway, that's what happened last night. The Indian Air Force struck place. For fellas like me, Kashmir used to mean the Kashmiri song, which we played on our music show not so long ago. Pale Hands I Loved Beside the Shalimar. That was Kashmir. Then along came Indian and Pakistani independence in 1947. And the creation of Pakistan was the single worst decision of imperial policymakers of the last three quarters of a century. Absolutely disastrous. What's his name? Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan and Pakistan's first governor general. He died within a year. He was very sick with cancer. And I'm not so sure. Lord Mountbatten, whose fault this largely is, was in a hurry. He thought the thing to do was to get it done and get the hell out. If he'd waited till Jinnah had died, things might have gone very differently. But he didn't. He wasn't a chap who thought in that kind of way. And so as a result, we have Pakistan. And as a result, we have this problem with Kashmir. And the interesting aspect about it is it's been a problem, and it is a problem that has not been solved virtually since the creation of independent India and Pakistan, as I said, in 1947. For example, the first Indo-Pakistani war, I'm going to see if I can remember all this, all the details, but it happened over what was then the princely state of Kashmir, which was not technically part of British Empire, but was a de facto British protectorate. And so in 1947, right, you've got Mountbatten as Governor General in independent India. This is just a few weeks after independence. And you've got Jinnah as the first Governor General of Pakistan in Islamabad. And What happens? So basically, you have, and regardless of that, in the princely state of Kashmir, in the in India, in Pakistan, because they just become independent, the commanders of all the armies, the Pakistani army and the Indian army, were all still Englishmen, except for, I will remember this, I can't remember his name, but the fellow who ran the army in the princely state of Kashmir, or Jammu and Kashmir, or Kashmir and Jammu, one or the other, or maybe even both. The commander of the army in Kashmir and Jammu was a Scotsman. So it's a war between India and Pakistan being fought by Englishmen and Scotsmen, as far as the commanders are concerned. And in fact, the overall commander at that time was still, what's the guy's name? Sir Claude Auchinleck, who was the supreme commander of British forces in both India and Pakistan. Yet they wound up going, all this derives from the war they had in 1947, where the commander-in-chief on both sides was King George VI, right? And the commanders were all these English guys with knighthoods, except for the one guy in the princely state who was a Scotsman. And yet, because both the Pakistanis and the India, oh, yes, I want to go to war, wanted to go to war, these and English officers died in this conflict in 1947. At least one English officer, I should remember his name, but it'll come to me. One English officer died in this war, basically fighting other English officers. So creating Pakistan. And at that point, they should have, well, it was too late by then. But anyway, the thing is, it's been, this is Kashmir. And again, it's Mountbatten's fault. This idea of trying to strong arm the princely states into joining either India or Pakistan is what made this this problem intractable, I would say. So the whole thing, the whole thing's been a disaster, and the only difference in those, as I said, in those days, you've got Pakistani Englishmen fighting Indian Englishmen, even though they all report to the same ultimate commander in chief, George VI. Once you get above the Governor General, and yet it still happens. And now all that's changed is that it's nuclear. And also the great powers during the Cold War bigged up both sides. So because the Soviets were hugely influential with India, because India, the Nehrus and the Gandhis were all basically socialists, America bigged up Pakistan, which became a sort of basket case of military dictatorships for a long while. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speaking more generally here. I don't know whether this will lead to war, because I assume for example, the American, I mean, people are relaxed about it because they say, oh, well, the Pentagon knows where all these nuclear sites are. So if it looked like it was going to get nuclear, they would go in and secure those sites. Really? Well, they missed the whole thing about Pakistan going nuclear. So I don't know whether that's... But here's my more general point. Don't you get the feeling that that war is inching nearer? A big war, we have this thing in this proxy war in Ukraine, which looks like it's not going to be stopped on day one, as they say. And at the same time, we have the Houthi basically targeting one of the key commercial arteries of the planet. And the Houthi aren't anybody that anyone had heard of. You know, the average American or European or whatever hadn't heard of these Houthi guys until 20 minutes ago. Don't you get the feeling that somewhere, and so we've got Trump who's got to keep an eye on all these things. We haven't even factored in China and Taiwan or anything like that. We haven't really even factored in Russia. Russia's been awfully sporting in not escalating a war that is largely, aside from American deep state blowing up European pipelines, the Russians have confined this thing to Ukraine. But don't you get the feel? Don't you get in that sort of playing croquet on the lawn in August 1914 that something out there is at some point going to spark a whole conflagration? That's what it feels a bit like to me. Queen of the Jungle says, congratulations, Mark, on the anniversary of one of the best shows online these days. It is worth every penny, not that it costs that much, to be allowed the privilege of asking you a question, much like the Oracle of Delphi. I've got a sort of bit of, I'm finding it hard to read at this distance. So I thought originally that said the Oracle of Delhi. I thought it was another point on India. I'm wondering what your take is on events taking place in the UK now that there is some kind of war starting with India and Pakistan. There are reports that, quote, an India-Pakistan war has the potential to split Britain's state in two and engulf its streets in sectarian violence. Since the UK is home to about 5 million ethnic Indians and Pakistanis, and both groups are prone to riots, particularly against one another. Meanwhile, Labour MP Tahir Ali led a letter-writing initiative to lobby the British government to build an international airport in Mirpur, the region from where a majority of Pakistani rape gang perpetrators come from. All spoke alongside independent Gaza-obsessed MP Ayub Khan at a Ali spoke alongside independent Gaza-obsessed MP Ayub Khan at a Pakistani community event in Birmingham to demand the airport be built. While in an act of ethno-religious solidarity, Khan dismissed the rape gang scandal as a false right-wing narrative done in order to sow division. Of course, the useless and disgusting police force are preparing for action by practicing their moves against mock rioters wearing Union flag t-shirts and apparel. I don't think there is any coming back from all this. No. Basically, you have what happened in Leicester a year or two back was the 1947 Indo-Pakistan War recreated in the East Midlands of England. I think Leicester was the first town to go from majority Anglo-Celtic to minority Anglo-Celtic, or a lot of them following them. Birmingham now is heading for 40% Muslim. And so because you had these two communities who settled, but Birmingham has a lot of Indians too. So in Leicester, for example, there were all these rumours that the Hindus were coming to burn down the mosque. It is basically like the partition of India, but played out as a permanent feature of life. By the way, without wishing to get into sophisticated geopolitics, right? You have all these members of parliament elected to represent constituents in working class England. And yet their big issue, as Queen of the Jungle has just explained, is getting this new airport built in Mirpur, this part of Pakistan where mysteriously, sort of early in the last term before they break for summer at English schools, the 13-year-old girls all disappear from school, if you're in Bradford or if you're in Birmingham or whatever, because they've been sent back to Mirpur to be married to a cousin. And nobody says a word about it, because that would be culturally insensitive. And then people like Ayub Khan would attack you for spreading a false right-wing narrative. Or that Labour cabinet minister who says that if you talk about these things, they're just racist dog whistles. It isn't very difficult. If you import the third world, you import the quarrels of the third world. So if you import large numbers of people for whom Kashmir is important, then you will have political violence driven by the standoff over Kashmir on the streets of English cities. And at some point you'll have them in American cities too, because at one point, they used to just go to the mother country, as Chris Davis said. So they'd go to England and open up curry houses. And then after 1965, they figured out that they could go to America, and there were more opportunities in America. So now you have very powerful and established Indian communities in America. I don't even want to get into things like that, because I look at Birmingham, which was never the most attractive city in England. It was a big industrial powerhouse, the great heart of an important industrial nation not so long ago. And as a result, it didn't look terribly attractive, although it had attractive parts. Don't forget that that's where J.R.R. Tolkien's Shire is. Everyone thinks that's in New Zealand, but in fact it's in what was then leafy southern Birmingham. It's where Cadbury's chocolate and all that came from. It's a crap hole now. Everyone's upset because the garbage collectors are on strike. And there are these huge rats all running around the streets. But the last time I was in Birmingham, a couple of years ago, it was not when any garbage strike was going on. It was filthy. Just because it's, now, as I said, it's now heading up to 40% Muslim. And if you've been in Lahore, or even if you've been in parts of, say, Jordan, if you've been in the non-tourist parts of Amman, you'll know that they're filthy too. I was staggered when I drove across the border from Jordan into Iraq, and I went to Fallujah and Ramadi and all those towns in the western desert. I was astonished, you know, because you're thinking, where's the evidence that the Americans have blown up all these people? And you come across ruins of tanks, and you think, I remember coming across one tank where the people who'd been hit by the bomb were still inside the tank. And I thought, oh, God. And so I drove along to the next exit and pulled off to Rutbar, I think that town was. Rutbar, first town as you enter western Iraq. And it's a crap hole. There's garbage everywhere. There's no sense of municipal pride. So, you know, the nice bits of England, you drive, Garden Village of 2017. You know, they've won some award or whatever. You see the same thing in America and Canada and all over. They take a little bit of pride in their village, and it all looks nice. You go to any Muslim, even a small Muslim town like Rutbar in Iraq, and there's none of that. The Bedouin, everybody is all romantic about the my desert is waiting. You know, they got this whole Sheikh of Arabi thing going on. But if you go to a Bedouin encampment, it's like a huge mound of garbage. It's a landfill without the hole. And that's what Birmingham looks like now. You've got, because you've got all these halal butchers, so people are just, some guy in a Ford Cortina drives up with three carcasses in the back. You know, this is all in compliance with health and safety, I'm sure. And they're just like lugging dragging carcasses along the filthy pavement into the halal butchers. I mean, this whole multicultural thing is at odds with the entirety of human history. But as I said, when you import the third world, then things like Kashmir are now your domestic issue. So people will be losing or winning parliamentary seats on the basis of this. Everything comes down, you know, for 20, it's the Mark Stein Club's 8th birthday, and don't particularly want to do a big birthday special. But for 20 years at this shingle, the big issue has been mass migration, the great migrations. Because it's at the bottom of, if you're wondering why housing is so expensive in Sydney, it's because of migration. It's, if you're wondering why you go to your hospital, you go to your doctor and you can't get an appointment, it's because of migration. If you wonder why your kid isn't learning anything in school, it's because of migration. It's all migration. And migration is nothing to do with what the asshole, Chamber of Commerce write that affects every country. Think of us. They think, oh, we're importing bus drivers. We're importing people who turn down your sheet at the crappy chain hotel and leave a chocolate on the pillow. No, who thinks of themselves like that? Because as in all the places we've been talking about in northern England, they came to work in the mills and factories. Well, the mills and factories closed down anyway, and all these people stayed. And you realise, in fact, the mosque and madrasa is more important to them than the mills and factories. It's all, if you're not talking about immigration, you're wasting everybody's time. And if you talk, one of the great things about the time we've been talking about it here, and it's due to Trump more than anybody else, is that whole Bush era bollocks. Oh, we need people to come here and do the jobs Americans won't do. Uh-huh. Well, if there are jobs that Americans won't do, that's a structural defect that isn't going to be cured by immigration. And, oh, they just want to, what was it, Bush's line? They just want to come here and put food on their family. Yeah, like one of those halal carcasses being dragged through the streets. You know, this is not how this, you are destroying social tranquility. Doesn't matter whether you're importing Latin American gang members or whether you're importing fire-breathing imams. It is not how, diversity is where nations go to die. And that can't be said often enough. Scott Scherzer writes from Miami Beach and says, "Dear Mark, tomorrow marks my 8-year anniversary as a member of the Mark Stein Club. What took you so long, Scott? Are you saying you waited 48 hours to sign up? And I look forward to the 9th, assuming the club hasn't been blacklisted by my credit card issuer." Yeah, there's always that. "Your sane voice in a world growing increasingly more insane by the day is why I joined in the first place. Just one question. If the India-Pakistan tete-a-tete goes nuclear, will I get a refund for the coming year's membership?" There's no problem about that. I think there might be a problem, though, with postal delivery after when we've kicked off with nuclear winter. So you'll have to drag you and your melting face all the way to New Hampshire to collect the refund check in person. But other than that, it should all be working swimmingly. We joke about these things. But actually, civilization is a very delicate, very wispy gossamer over a hard crust of barbarism. And you don't have to have much going on before the gossamer all goes, and it's just the hard rock of barbarism underneath that's left. You know, you see that very, we were talking about it last week with the big blackout in Spain, Portugal, and a big chunk of France. Alyssa Angel says, "Mark, if you were chosen to be the Pope, which regnal name would you select and why?" I'm not sure I'm eligible to be Pope. I, uh, I have no idea who's going to be Pope. If they were to come to me and say, Mark, we're in a whole heap of trouble. Could you possibly step in? And you don't want to be Archbishop of Canterbury. That's over, that whole deal. They haven't had an Archbishop of Canterbury since January when that awful guy who did the King's coronation had to resign. And no one's noticed that there's no Archbishop of Canterbury, whereas they do notice when there's no Pope. I would choose Benedict, because he was the last Pope I liked. Benedict the 16th, I think. So that would make me Benedict the 17th. But I can't remember. Was this a line of Benedict the 16th himself, or was he just quoting the original Benedict? But he said, I think he was quoting the original Benedict, who, as I recall, was very fond of gardening analogies. But Benedict the 16th certainly quoted him, or said it himself, when he said, pruned it grows again, which means that, as we have seen remorselessly, church attendance has declined. And that eventually affects the quality. This, for example, is, I believe, the first papal conclave at which a majority of the attendees are not European. And the reason for that is that, you know, the church is in a very bad shape in continental Europe, extremely bad shape. I often talk about it when I'm in France, because it just saddens me that you have these beautiful 14th century churches, 12th century churches. So a millennium ago, people who didn't have all the tools we take for granted now, admittedly they didn't have to go and get all the zoning permits either, but 1,000 years ago, people were willing to invest time and energy in erecting a monument to God that they would never live to see. And it really saddens me, these beautiful churches, 12th and 14th century churches, and there's concerts in them. You know, I saw a touring Italian choral group in a beautiful 12th century church. But I would actually like to have heard Mass in it. And it's very, it's increasingly difficult to. So Benedict the 16th, when he said that line, pruned it grows again, he understood that the church was going to get smaller before it would grow again. Because apart from anything else, if you like take the Anglican Church, for example, and this is true not just for the Church of England, but also for the Anglican Church of Canada and the Episcopal Church in the USA, you've got to get rid of, you've got to prune all the garbage that is an obstacle to growth. So you've got to get rid of all the rubbish, like that bishop. I can't remember that bishop who upbraided Trump in the National Cathedral, whether she was actually trans or just looked like she was trans. Very hard to tell with Episcopal bishops. But anyway, you've got to get rid of all that crowd before, you've got to prune it, as Benedict said, before it can grow again. You can't just say, okay, we've got a gay bishop here, and we've got a trans bishop here, and we've got, and now let's try and build on that, because you're building on, you're not serious about faith, and you're not going, so all the people who are serious about faith are increasingly from other parts of the church. But I was struck by that. I thought that was a very good line of Pope Benedict, or the first Benedict, whichever one it was, but pruned it grows again. And there has to be some serious kind of pruning before it will grow again. So that's what I would. I would be Pope Benedict. Well, now you've talked me into picking out a name. I'm rather sad I'm not eligible for it, unfortunately. Texas Opt Optimist writes, "The magnificent week of sun, sea, and civilizational decline." Wait, civilizational collapse? Isn't that our slogan? Sun, sea, and civilizational collapse. That's the Mark Stein Crew slogan. Because one year we're going to be at sea, and we're going to return to whatever the port we're supposed to be ending the cruise at, and we won't be able to because civilization will have collapsed. But anyway, you said it was far better than I had imagined. The inspirational company of Stein Cruises left me feeling surprisingly optimistic about our hopes of forging a post-Cold War bastion of liberty in some parts of the world. In War of 1812, the rematch this Monday regarding Canada as the 51st state, you observed what started out as a mildly amusing bit of presidential trolling is now being discussed as next year's Donbass. And later, I have no idea where this is headed, and if anyone can enlighten me, I'd be happy to hear it. Is this explanation plausible? As for Carney, he is taking this opportunity to butch up, confront Trump, and hopefully build a bit of populist credibility with Canadian patriots. And Trump is reinforcing his flamboyant opening bid in the negotiation with the Canadian people, in which Trump aims to shake loose the Chinese communist grip on Canada, as I believe you have suggested previously. Yeah, that's true. Up to a point. But, you know, the Chinese communist grip on America is more important for the world. Because a country that doesn't make anything isn't a country. And as I think I also said in that piece, basically over the last 30 years, America has been turned into a low-wage service economy. Even if you want to boycott China, it's all but impossible to do because it would involve boycotting your prescription drugs and stuff like that, and your laptop. So you wouldn't even be able to find out whether your boycott's effective because there's no non-Chinese-made device you can get. That we gave away everything, or more to the point, the Chamber of Commerce right gave away everything. I mentioned that stupid National Review cover story from 20 years ago about Walmart, called America's Store. Everything in Walmart is made in China, and Americans get to be the greeters. That's it. So one country supplies the greeters, and another country supplies all the products. Well, which one do you think is going to come out on top of that relationship? And the stupid Conservative Inc., the National Review's cover story, they put Walmart in, you know, some Walmart. They all look the same, so I couldn't tell you which town it's in. On the cover with the headline, America's Store. It's China's store. You got a country that doesn't make anything isn't a country. And this is why getting, you know, it's all very well worrying about the fact that the Chinese own the Carney family and the Trudeau family. But as we know, they also own the Biden family and the McConnell family, you know. George Pereira says, 8 years, very nice. Mark Carney, no relation to Art Carney, meets with President Donald J. Trump and tells him to stop calling Canada the 51st state because it hurts his feelings. Well, President Donald J. Trump's eyes light up like a kitten that's been given a catnip-infused ball of yarn. If you're thinking of reading more nonfiction, says George, may I suggest The Battle of Jutland by John Buchan. Richard Hannay's part in the battle has been long overlooked. Mark Lipniacki, or Lipniacki, I hope I've pronounced one or other of it in some semi-semblance of accuracy. Greetings, Mark. In that awkward meeting in the White House, there was a priceless moment when Lacani looked like an old maid who had been mortally offended by something terribly, terribly indelicate. They say that Lacani is a good Soros boy. For all that, Lacani is no ornament to any state. Your thoughts? Well, Carney won. He didn't win big, but he won enough. And this is the problem. You have to think. You know, I was interested. Poilievre looks like a genius compared to Peter Dutton in Australia, but they both lost. So Pierre Poilievre is going to be spending another half decade as leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition in Ottawa, and Peter Dutton isn't even going to be doing that. And we can't afford, as I've said, this is basically, Trump won. People didn't expect Trump to win. He won. That's America's last chance. We are in the last, for most of the Western world, we are in the last election cycle where it will be possible to change things. So Starmer, for example, can hang on till 2029. In the UK. And by 2029, it will be all but impossible to save anything. And if you look at the solutions they're talking about, there's that wanker at GB News, Andrew Pearce, is talking about bringing Bojo back, Boris Johnson. Johnson did all this to you. People hate the Conservative Party, because the Conservative Party is responsible for the fact that all the money is going to illegal migrants to house them in hotels while you can't see a doctor. So the point here is that when we hear all this consultancy-driven politics, you know, words that work, as Frank Luntz likes to say, and nobody likes to hear you talking about this talk because it, like, harshes their mellow, and they just rather hear bollocks. Well, the bollocks is what's killed your country. And so if you want to have a chance of change, you can't do that. At some point, someone's going to actually, instead of moving towards the centre, someone is going to have to get off his flabby ass and move the centre towards him, which is what, in different contexts, Thatcher and Reagan did in the 70s and 80s. You're going to have, politics is about persuasion. It's possible to do it. Farage and I were on stage in Toronto in a huge hall just filled with wanker Toronto liberals, and we caused the biggest swing that they'd ever had in the Monk debate. I don't know whether it's been beaten since, but Rudyard, the moderator, he was absolutely stunned by that. Because he didn't. Everyone thought we were a joke. All the media in the room covering it, like the wanker from the Globe and Mail and my former opening act wanker, Jonathan Kay, they said that Farage and I were porn-obsessed cartoons, right? Because we wanted to talk about child rape by migrants. So we're porn-obsessed cartoons. They thought we were cartoons. And so did the audience when we went in. The initial poll they took was 90-10 against us. And then suddenly we were like, well, maybe the porn-obsessed cartoons have a point. And what I was reminded of there, and I just say this, I quoted in that piece the SAS slogan, who dares wins. If you don't dare, like that Peter Dutton in Australia, if you don't dare, no one's going to reward you. People have gotten it. That, you know, oh, I called my doctor to see if I could come in for an appointment, and his secretary sent me a YouTube video I could watch on how to deal with stage 4 cancer, because the doctor's not available until September 2028, and they think that might be a bit late for me. This is, why is this? It's because you're taking in, oh, look, there's another 1,000 Albanian sex traffickers washing up on the beach. And oddly enough, they get priority for housing, for education, for a government debit card, for a and for the hospital. And yeah, they're not Albanian sex traffickers yet, yet on the Rio Grande, but they're just MS-13 gang members. So at least they don't want to make your women folk wear burqas, but they do want to carve their brands into various parts of your women folk's skin. It all comes back to migration. And if you're too big a pansy to talk about that, as Dutton and Poilievre were, then why would you be surprised that, oh, amazingly, yes, unfortunately, the Right of Centre Party, which I'm not sure is even a correct designation anymore, oh, unfortunately, they narrowly lost again. But just you wait, in another half decade's time, this time we'll do it. Yeah, well, they put on an extra 500,000 Muslims every half decade in Canada, so you do the arithmetic on that. You know, you've got to be able to persuade. If you're not interested in persuading, you shouldn't be in sodding politics at all. These people are getting ridiculous. Oh, look at this. Charlie Citrine. Mark, I'm sure he's a big Nigel fan. I'm sure you'll want to join me in congratulating Nigel Farage on Reform's superb showing in the UK local elections. I've already done that. You got to get up earlier to make snide remarks, Charlie. I did that yesterday. Things are looking set fair for Nigel to be our next PM. But one thing worries me. Could Ben Habib's Integrity Party snatch victory from his grasp? Why, I hear they've already amassed 700 members. Your thoughts? I think he's tried comedy. I've said Nigel is... I gave credit to Nigel. I don't like him because he teamed up with Flopidopoulos to try to kill me. I don't particularly want to talk about this, but as you know, I had my, as some of you know, I had my first heart attack in London, actually on air during the GB News show on the Monday, but I didn't recognise it as such. And so on Friday morning, I flew back to France, where I was spending my weekends in those days, and I had my second heart attack as I was leaving the airport and driving through the Alps. And because of that, I'm alive today, because as Nurse Audrey said, I was within 15 minutes of death. And if you're within 15 minutes of death when you have a heart attack in London, you'll die. Because they're not going to get you to hospital. You know, we ran all these stories on GB News about people waiting, old-timers, octogenarians, lying in the street for 48 hours waiting for an ambulance. We used to run all those stories. So I'd be dead. And the thing was, that's what Flopidopoulos, with the backing of Nigel Farage, wanted, because that would have been great. Oh, such a shame. But Mark Stein had a heart attack and died last night. And we're very sorry about that, because he was such an asset to the show and people liked him and all the rest of it. But now he's dead, so we'll get the president of His Majesty's Privy Council to take over the show. And that's what they wanted. And then when they discovered I was in the ICU, this is all while I was in the ICU in... Well, I was for a week. I was getting all this then, because I hadn't had the good grace to die. I'm getting all this bollocks, including from Farage, which I mentioned before, giving basically inventing his own medical bulletin for me. Anyway. So I'm coming under all this pressure in the ICU. The nurses, my delightful Provençal nurses, couldn't get over it. So Nigel, it's all about Nigel with Nigel. He's what Jane Clark, speaking of her husband, the late Alan Clark, Mrs. Thatcher's defence minister, used to call an SH1T, which is Jane Clark thought it was funny because it was like her husband's personalised license plate. Nigel is a classic SH1T, And so, the first thing he did after winning this thing was to then piss all over Ben Habib and Rupert Lowe. He's personally an evil man, I would say. This Rupert Lowe thing now, where Zia Yusuf, Nigel's Muslim sugar daddy. So how's that going to... You know, the other thing I've learned about Nigel Farage is that the grooming gang girls hate him. Absolutely hate him. Because he claims to, no one's fought harder than me. And they say, well, wait a minute, what are you on about? You made over 15 years, you made like 5 comments on it, but actually doing anything, you don't. So he's got the Muslim sugar daddy now. And the Muslim sugar daddy reports Rupert Lowe to the police for threatening his life. And the Metropolitan Police, being dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt cop, I'll tell you this, if I'm better when the election comes in 2029 and I stand against Nigel in Clacton or whatever, one of my election pledges would be to abolish the Met and start from scratch, because they're corrupt. So now they've decided, because Rupert Lowe is always going on about the police corruption with the gang-raped girls, is that, oh yes, he did threaten to kill Zia Yusuf. So we've reported him to the Director of Public Prosecutions, right? Zia Yusuf, Rupert Lowe is a 70-year-old man. And Zia Yusuf is half this age. I've never seen a bigger wanker since that guy who was married to Liza Minnelli. And he files for divorce. He's dead now, poor fellow. He files for divorce and he says, oh, Liza beat the crap out of him. Right? Liza's the big spousal abuser. And Liza was 15 years older than him. And had 2 hip replacements. So I said, well, why didn't the husband just run for his life? Or, in fact, stroll for his life? Because what kind of man says that Liza Minnelli beat him up? Well, Zia Yusuf is the Liza Minnelli's husband of British politics. Rupert Lowe, you have to be, only a British Brit wanker copper would be stupid enough to think that Rupert Lowe, a 70-year-old man, could beat up this 35-year-old Zia Yusuf. And then this thing where, oh, he's got dementia. Oh, right. Now, so Dr. Farage and Dr. Yusuf has prescribed. He is an SH1T. He's a complete. And the thing about it is, I congratulated him, Charlie Citrine, because what he is good at doing, it's his principal skill, is destroying things. Just as he destroyed UKIP and he destroyed... these other parties, because he resigns as leader and can't support the next leader because the next leader but he is good at destroying things. And if he destroys the Conservative and Unionist Party, which is 35 years past any use it might once have had, he will be doing a great service. And if he destroys the party, and you can mock, you know, Ben Habib, you can mock Rupert Lowe, you can mock me, you can mock all the people who have, Nigel has eventually decided, as he said of Ben Habib, are just small, insignificant, nothing people that nobody needs. But, in the end, a party has to have dull, non-charismatic people to... serve as Minister for Transport and to move the airport expansion bill in Mirpur in Pakistan. You've got to be able to get on with dweeby wanker losers who are way crapper than you, who can't pull the birds like you can, who haven't got all those notches on the bedpost like Nigel seven times a night Farage has, and all the other strange planted stories about him that appear hither and yon. No, you've got, that's the name, politics can't just be for one super personality guy. He's already started, some of these councillors who were elected on Thursday, last Thursday, he's already terminated their commission. But he is good at destroying things. And so The tragedy for Nigel is he won that. Well, he didn't win it. It's probably more to do with Boris, who's another guy who's good at destroying things. But whatever, he'd been working on Brexit for 20 years or whatever it was, and he got it over the line. And then he bungled it so that there's no real Brexit, but he can't say that because he's running as Mr. Brexit. But he is good at destroying things. He is good at destroying things. He came very close, literally, to destroying me when I was in the ICU and there was all this bollocks coming from London. You know, they couldn't... having failed, you know, so I didn't have the fatal heart attack in London. I had the near-fatal heart attack in France. But they thought, well, he's in the ICU. If we sort of pile it on, maybe it'll just be a one-way ticket in and he'll never come out. He's not a nice guy. I say that. I stood on a stage with him. And, you know, as I said, that was the biggest swing ever. You can go back and watch that debate. When I did my bit, pushback against Simon Sharma and Louise Arbour, I got a bit too far out on my skis for Nigel's comfort zone there. But unless you want to live in a semi-Muslim, quote unquote, for the moment, semi-Muslim society, the pace has got to be picked up. The pace has got to be picked up because it's not going anywhere good. We're running out of time. I'm awfully late getting to the bit of the show that everybody likes, which is the little bit where Mark Stein pops in to tell us what's coming up on his music show. And people love this. Absolutely love it. It's their favourite 30 seconds of the show. So here is the one and only Mr. Stein to tell you all about our weekend music show. Go, Mark. Hey, this is Mark Stein on the town this week. Songs across the century and around the world. I'll have Texans and Tuscans. Plus, we'll play some choo-choo songs, and Frank Sinatra's pianist and musical director joins me to recall Sinatra the Conductor. On the town, Saturday at 5 on 7-8 Radio. And Saturday at 5 London time is 6 p.m. in Western Europe or 12 midday in North American Eastern. This is Mark Stein live around the planet. It's 4 to 4 Eastern time. That's 4 to 9 British summertime. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Oh, Nick Russell, here's another question about Farage. Hi, Mark, you've been very critical about Farage's gatekeeping. However, perhaps that worked in his interest in the recent local election. Operative words, in his interest. Since a large section of the electorate have only the most peripheral interest in politics, his avoidance of controversy seems to have served him well. Oh, were you talking about the Australian guy or the Canadian guy now? If he had made a stand on first principles and defended Tommy Robinson or been more vociferous on rape gangs and remigration, he would have created a furore which would have disgraced qualified Reform as a credible party for many. While I completely concur with you on your condemnation of Farage for his many human frailties, his long experience of politics and his astute understanding of the electorate have allowed him to forge a path to real political power. To get Reform across the finishing line, he has to make some strategic sacrifices. Isn't that a price worth paying, given the quality of our electorate? Every viable candidate has to do that to some degree or another. Giorgia Meloni has had to do it. Marine Le Pen has had to do it. The AFD, that lesbian gal, have had to do it. But nobody does it on the scale Nigel does, which is why Musk and Trump have concluded that, you know, he isn't really... You look at Trump. You look at Trump in 2016. We need a ban on immigration from Muslim countries, in his words, until we can figure out what the hell's going on. You know, he says these things and he gets elected. And then on the first day, he's got all these things. You know, that's the thing. We've got this. He claims to be a friend of Trump, which is mostly fantasy on Farage's part. But you have this tremendous energy in the executive. So that, for example, the border crossings have fallen by, I think, something like 94% since January the 20th. So it can, you can do things, even when you're up against everybody, as Trump is and as any populist PM in Downing Street would be. But do you really think that Farage is going to cut migrants by 94%? This is going to, Britain, there's no point talking about the 2029 election, because on this rate, there's not going to be anything left to save in 2029. Not on these numbers. Not on the numbers that are being spent. It turns out that, oh yes, we allocated a certain amount of money to take care of these people who are washing up on the beaches. Just last year, they allocated this sum. It's actually now, I think, three or four times the daily cost, what they were expecting it to be. As I said, you know, it's all about the realm of the possible. It's all about, you know, Marine Le Pen decided she was going to reinvent herself as this harmless cat lady. Giorgia Meloni moderated her tone. No one's done it on this scale. And then you compare the thing about Tommy Robinson, you know, and I know it's a class thing in Britain and all that kind of stuff. Tommy Robinson didn't know Sammy. You know, I met Sammy. The gang rape thing is a deal breaker with me. If you're a big enough SH1T, as Jane Clark liked to say, that you don't care about hundreds of thousands of little girls being gang raped. You know, Sammy Woodhouse. Sammy reminded me on the cruise that when the first time we met, I'd gone to Rotherham and I checked into this weird crap hotel in Rotherham. I'm not sure there were any other kind. But anyway, I was in that hotel and Sammy came over because I was staying there. Sammy came over to my hotel for lunch. That was the first time we met. And Sammy reminded me on the cruise that she'd actually been raped in that hotel. You know, so we have these people and we were just talking back and forth about all the figures. The guys who featured in this, Lord Armoured, eventually he was found out. We had Sammy on the show to talk about this. Lord Armoured, whom Tony Blair put in the House of Lords, he's one of the pedo rapists. Yeah, a pedo rapist in, I'm assuming you're a citizen or at least resident of the United Kingdom, Nick. But a pedo rapist was sitting in the House of Lords. They're as connected as you can get, and no one's going to do anything to you. You've just had a cabinet minister when somebody brought it up on any questions on Radio 4. It's the BBC show that's been running for 70 years or something. I think it started in the 1940s. Any questions? One of the most venerable BBC shows. And some guest brings up the gang rape thing. And she says, oh, dog whistle much? Yeah, you're just like blowing a trumpet to all the racists out there. She's in the bastard bollocking British cabinet. Your girls are being raped. That's not something that you just triangulate. I just said that. I just mentioned that now. You know, I went to Rotherham, right? I was, apart from the guy from the Times, nobody had covered that story. Nobody had thought to go to Rotherham and talk to these girls. I was astonished by that, because it's very easy. There's so much of it that it's actually quite easy to get in touch with these girls. There's so much of it going on. I'm getting annoyed here. I probably shouldn't be getting annoyed. But it disgusts me, because there's nothing to be said that is for society. And so then when Sammy reminds me that we actually had lunch in some crap hotel in which, in one of the upstairs rooms, she'd been raped. You know, oh, well, let's just, I'm all about positioning, because I don't want to disturb anybody in the electorate. Tommy Robinson, you can say what you like about Tommy Robinson, but he's gone to jail and he's in solitary confinement. His life is wrecked. His life is wrecked. And at some point, you got to have some skin in the game. Nigel was broke a couple of years ago, absolutely broke. He was skint. He was like the old Kenny Everett joke about he's got the spanner out and he's with his motorcycle. And the guy says to Kenny, what's the problem? And he goes, piston broke. And the guy goes, yeah, so what's different? And that's Nigel, piston broke. And now he's got the Muslim sugar daddy. He's even less likely to do the racist. When are these girls going to stop being gang raped? You see it every day. You see it every day. Starmer, oh, Musk has made a fuss about it. So let's announce some inquiries, but they'll be local inquiries. So we're going to give them some money for local inquiries. And then they decide, oh, no, it's not for local inquiries. It's just for them to spend as they see fit. Come on, man. I mean, what I've, you know, when we have Sammy Woodhouse on the cruise, and we have Samantha Smith was another of my guests, and people think, oh, well, they're very together. Sammy is one of the bravest. Sammy Woodhouse is one of the bravest women I know. Samantha is. You know, Samantha, her abuse began at the... When I first met Samantha Smith, she was like 2 years away from the abuse ending. And she couldn't remember before the abuse began, because it started at five, all the sexual abuse. In Telford, a new town, a so-called new town. It's been going on as long as those towns have existed. People are complicit in it. The longer it goes on without anybody getting... And just to come back to my point about Sammy and Samantha, because I want to emphasise this. I've met a lot of other girls. I met that first trip to Rotherham. I had lunch with Sammy and her friend. And they were very together. They were a great laugh. They're enormously strong, and they have a perspective on the way their lives were destroyed. And then you meet other girls, and they're just like you would expect a victim of 10 years of gang rape to be. They're ruined. They're walking husks. You know, even if you were to say to them, look, there's a job opening for a waitress coming up. They've had 10 years of gang rape. They've been locked up in a flat for days on end and raped over and over. The other girl, the other Samantha in Oldham, who at the time Nigel got rid of me was supposed to be coming on the show that week. Samantha was picked up in the lobby of Oldham Police Station. She'd been raped and she went to report the rape and the desk sergeant sloughed her off. And so while she's standing in the lobby wondering what to do, this is a 12-year-old girl. A couple of other guys come along, hustle her into a car, rape her all over again, then dump her in the park where some other guy comes along, takes her back to a flat, and there's, I think, five or six guys all raping her all night long. The one guy was running the rape gangs out of the welfare office in Oldham. You know, this isn't about triangulation. It's a country, a society that won't save its 12-year-old girls from serial, industrial-scale gang rape is not worth saving. It's not worth... So, yes, oh, Nigel's very clever. Yes, Nigel's very clever. He's triangulated himself into sweeping the local council elections. Right, OK, can you tell me the local council elections in... 2006, 1998, 1986. No, you can't, because they're not important, because they're like the European election that Farage won, that accomplished the desired result of ending Theresa May's bollocksing of Brexit and brought in Boris Johnson to bollocks it. But it doesn't tell you anything about who's going to be elected as MPs. Local these are not federal. I'm not even talking about the United States, where states in a state like New Hampshire, you know, everything is done at town level. And so the next one up, county level, does hardly anything. Right. So local elections have some actual real world meaning there. I'm not even talking about Australia or Canada, where they are federations and where the states and provinces also have real power. We're talking about something that ought to be important, but isn't important because it's everything is very centrally controlled. It doesn't tell you anything about who's going to be the Prime Minister in 2029. At some point, you need a guy who's willing to play on the left's turf. Basically, what Nigel did to Rupert Lowe, whether you think he's, if you take the Charlie Citrine view, Rupert Lowe and Ben Habib, these are just nothing insignificant wanker assholes, never going to get anywhere. That's true. But do they deserve to have Nigel and his Muslim sugar daddy saying they've got dementia and say, oh, I'm a fit, vigorous 35-year-old Muslim sugar daddy and this 70-year-old geezer threatened to beat me up. Oh, they're all left-wing things. Nigel is such a left-wing prat. That Nigel said, oh, I think if you criticise Zia Yusuf, you're racist. I'm frankly shocked, he said to some wanker Fleet Street journalist. I'm frankly shocked that there haven't been calls for investigation for the racism of criticising Zia Yusuf. The guy is playing on the left's turf all the time. He's good at destroying things. Usually he destroys those closest to him and his own political parties. But on Thursday, he actually did quite a bit of good work destroying the unwanted Conservative and Unionist Party. And that's a rare example of Nigel applying his skills successfully. I've gotten all worked up. I'm going to have a third heart attack. Not a third heart. I've already had. Where did I have my third heart attack? I think that was in... Trieste. There's a dispute between my American doctor and my Quebec doctor about how many heart attacks I've had. It's like that congressional district in upstate New York where they have to keep having recounts. I'm thrilled by that. I shouldn't have got all worked up because I'm actually in quite a good mood. But I don't know. I don't like Nigel. You wouldn't like Nigel. I'm not even... I can extend it. You know, there are people who have made the mistake of getting involved, shall we say, with Nigel in... Bill Bradshaw says, "Dear Mark, this is only my second year as a Steinclubber, and I'm very pleased." But by the way, here, all the time we've been... At this website, I used to do jokes about when Al Gore launched his presidential campaign. Al Gore has lived in Washington all his life. His dad was a senator, and he grew up at whatever that hotel is in Washington, D.C. But when he decided he was running for president to launch his campaign, he flew back to his alleged country home and posed in a field of cows. And I just did, you know, jokes about Herd's Rent-A-Cow or whatever. I just did knockabout about passing political figures. But after I went, as I said, I've talked about this before, that moment in outside the maternity store in Vienna when I saw the people going into that store and then coming out with all the baby stuff, all these covered women going into the maternity store in Vienna, which I hadn't thought of as Muslim in any sense, not even in the immigrant sense as one does with France or the UK. And so you come out and then you look into it, because Austria is one of the few countries that keeps statistics and things like this, and you realize that a majority of the Austrians under the age of 20 are going to be Muslim. And then you look at Brussels, where I think it's 88% of whatever it is, under 20 or under 18 or under whatever it is, residents of Brussels are foreign born. Now, I wrote about this because first wrote about this a couple of years after 9/11. Then I did a book about it because that's a big bloody thing. And as I always say, all these princes and presidents and prime ministers called me in to chit chat with me about it. Dick Cheney said it was a paradigm shift because that's the way he talks, and then none of them did anything about it. Well, unfortunately, that was two decades ago when it was still possible to change the trajectory. So if Nigel is still not willing to address issues honestly, the code about when his thing is that, if we pick a fight with all of Islam, we'll lose. That's code for the demographic transformation is too far gone to be reversed now. You know, so that's great. He won the local election. I mean, for a start, the local elections were mostly in England. So we're not talking about Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales. He'd do quite well in Wales, I grant you. And they weren't in all of England because Starmer cancelled a lot of elections or postponed them till next year or whatever. They tell you nothing about the politics of 2029. They really don't. I just don't want to spend... You keep all my... All this century, all this... You know, I was told, and I accepted it for a bit, that when Bush, after 9/11, does all his Islam is a religion of peace thing. So after 9/11, everyone goes and does photo ops at mosques with the big bearded imams. You know, I don't, that it's never about that. I don't even want to invade, you know, Somalia or Sudan or any of these places. I just want... us not to lose some of the most highly evolved societies in the world. And most people couldn't stick it for a moment living in that kind of society. They'll accept it because the alternative will be going a lot. But go and look at Birmingham with all the carcasses being dragged through the streets to the halal butchers as rats scurry around. It's you don't even have to be sophisticated about this. You don't actually have to project numbers. Just look at what the average English city looks like now compared to what it looked like the day before yesterday. I've gone on too long. I'm sorry I got carried away. It's really not good for me. I'm not in great health. And to be honest, the reality of what's happening, it's accelerating now. So all this, again, all this, you've got to have people prepared to actually, politics is about addition. So you can give Farage credit for adding to his party's score. But at the same time, it's supposed to be addition in persuading people to your identification of the core issues and their solution. That's all it is. I apologise for getting carried away. Did I swear? I remember when Ava swore on one of our TV shows and she got annoyed about something and she used the F word, which I think we bleeped out. But the first thing she did the following week was apologise for saying that. So if I got carried away and said the F word, I do apologise. Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A. This has been. That's going to do it for today. But do stick with Steyn Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura's going to round up the internet as only she can. Also, we have ongoing Pope Watch updates for you fellas who are sitting agog at the edge of your seat watching events in Rome and the Vatican. Our Mark Steyn Club 8th birthday observers since go on with our 70th Tale for Our Time, Three Men on the Bummel by Jerome K. Jerome. The latest episode airs in a few hours' time. And we'll also have something a little special for you on Friday. We talk, there's issues I'm not, I joke about the who's 2 points up in Iowa. Well, you know, Nigel was up 17 points in Cleethorpes or whatever. But I'd forgotten. I'm ashamed to say I'd forgotten that Sammy had come over and had lunch with me in a awful, awful hotel where she was raped as a child. And if those girls aren't important to citizens of the United Kingdom, then I'm sorry, but the United Kingdom deserves to go out of business, as it surely is on the present trajectory. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, well, we've made it 8 years so far, and we are looking forward to more, as long as my bum ticker can hang on. So come on in, the water's fine. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.